because I refuse to pretend to a class I am not.
She is not of that class.
I am not of the petticoat class. I am Almira Davenport.
Is that Almira Davenport? Let her in.
It was the man behind us.
She does video installation. Very strange. Very compelling.
The line began to buzz.
Yes, I think I've heard of her, I heard someone say. Didn't she paint herself purple on top of the Eiffel Tower?
Yes.
Like magic, Holmes produced a fistful of business cards from her pocket and began passing them out to the crowd.
Is your work up for auction, dear?
The man's wife asked, touching my shoulder.
It is up for auction, I intoned.
You'll have to wait for the very end, Holmes said with a wink. When the best always comes.
And dragged me in by the wrist, past the protesting clerk, past the small throng of men in sport coats, and all the way down the end to the lofted center hall of the museum. A stage had been set up, with an auctioneer's podium. Seats were arranged in two cascading wings. From the looks of it, Hadrian and Philippa's art auctions attracted a good 100 people, and most of them had managed to come out, even with such short notice.
"I've heard they have some incredible find they're auctioning off," the man next to us was saying.
"It isn't even in the catalogue,"
his friend replied, too quiet to hear.
"No," he said, "they're on the up-and-up. These two scout the globe for a living. Of course they're bringing home fabulous work that was thought to be lost. Doesn't mean it's stolen. Didn't you see Hadrian on Art World today? He addressed this very subject."
Holmes and I toured the room. She shook hands while I glowered into the distance. Everyone, it seemed, had heard of us from somewhere they couldn't really remember. Liars. All of them. It was incredible the lengths people would go to feel like they were in the know. As we made the rounds, we kept hearing that same echoed uncertainty about the legitimacy of Hadrian and Philippa's catalogue. Someone would say, "But all of these paintings were presumed lost," and someone else would reassure them, too loudly,
"So they must be very good at finding them."
The whole room stank of desperation, and Holmes flitted through it, tossing her bristly wig and ranting on about art and the intellect and the soul. She sounded like Nathaniel Ziegler on steroids, which I think was probably the point. My throat was going dry. I still wasn't feeling like myself. To be honest, with every hour I discovered a new part of me that hurt, and I pulled Holmes away so that I could regroup.
"Are you enjoying yourself?" I asked her.
"Immensely."
"Do you see Peterson and his squad?"
"He was in line behind us outside. You didn't recognize the old man, the one who'd heard of Almira? Or did you think I'd built a fabulous art world reputation in the last 90 minutes?
I snorted.
"That was Peterson?"
"The rest of his squad is coming, and Tom and Lena have seats in the front row. Look for the girl in fur.
Tell me it isn't, like, actual fur."
Holmes adjusted her poncho.
"Lena isn't above killing for what she wants."
We surveyed the room, shoulder to shoulder. I spotted August across the room, leaning indolently against the stage, and yanked my gaze away. I didn't want to call attention to him.
"Honestly, I'm feeling pretty good about this. I'd be feeling even better if I didn't look like the Elephant Man."
"It was either that or we covered your bruises in white stage makeup and brought you along as my mime."
I reached under my rubber mask to touch my neck. One of my abrasions, as the nurse called them, had started to bleed again. Not that anyone would be able to tell. Only my eyes and mouth were showing. The rest of my face and my neck down to the collarbone was covered in a series of exaggerated pixelations, the kind of scrambling they did to naked photos when they showed them on cable TV. I was a walking censor bar. Cameras wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of me, or that was the idea that I'd explained to anyone who asked.
"Your partner in mime?"
"Very high concept,"
Holmes said, mimicking Kincaid's Frankenstein's monster delivery.
"Very cutting edge."
A group of old women tottered by to claim their paddles from the auctioneer. All were dressed to the nines. One fiddled with a jeweled reindeer pin on her hat. I hadn't seen Hadrian at all yet. I was dreading that. But Philippa was standing next to the auctioneer, smiling like a wind-up doll. Who are all these people? This is a last-minute thing on Christmas Eve. Shouldn't they be home with their families? Holmes gave me a pointed look.
Marketing, Watson. A small auction of select rare works from their collection. A string quartet playing Handel. Snacks. The architecturally lauded modern art museum rented out for the evening. Of course they've all come out. It smacks of exclusivity. Privilege.
I'm still stuck on the part where you use the word snacks in your argument.
Clearly, she said, they're hors d'oeuvres. I just didn't know if you're familiar with the term. You don't speak French, do you?
Since last night, something between us had eased. It was more like we'd both been pulling desperately at opposite ends of the same rope, and now we'd walked to the middle to fold it up together. Last night had been... Honestly, I wasn't even sure if it had really happened. In the middle of the night, in a city like Prague, the girl that I loved slipped into my bed. I couldn't find a way to describe it without using simple, stupid terms. It had been difficult. She was beautiful. We'd both been frustrated. She'd said my name. I never wanted to make her cry again. All I knew was that I didn't want us to fight anymore. I didn't want to try to kiss her, either. Not until I understood it. Us, better. I wanted to exist in this stasis as long as we could, this place where we were tentatively getting along. The thing was, since it was the two of us, our not fighting looked a lot like... fighting. I took French, I reminded her. I've taken French for years. You met me outside of French class almost every day this fall.
I did not. Surely I'd remember that.
You did. You know you did, too. You're just being difficult.
I have an impeccable memory, Watson. Say something to me in French.
No.
You can't say anything to me in French. A phrase? A word?
I can, but I won't.
See? My point. You can't say a word.
Hors d'oeuvres, I said, and snagged a pair of blintzes from a passing waiter's tray. Do you want one? Beneath the wig, beneath the Coke bottle glasses, despite every fight we'd had in the past few weeks and the ridiculous plastic mask I wore, Charlotte Holmes was looking at me like I was her violin. It was a look she hadn't given me at all last night, and I didn't know what that meant.
Give my love to Watson, I said softly.
Her eyes didn't change.
August told you that?
He had, as he'd muscled me through the roof access door and down to Milo's personal infirmary. I'd been laid out on an uncomfortable hospital bed. Why did it always end with me in a hospital bed? And was asked if I remembered the past few hours, where I'd been... I did. I told her to run, I told August, who put a hand on my shoulder.
She's in the helicopter. She said to give you her love.
When he said it, he looked sad, and not for himself. It took me a second to process it. The first part doesn't make sense, I said, but the second is just crazy.
He's fine, August advised the nurses. Get him acetaminophen and an ice pack.
He did tell me, I said.
Is that okay?
She brushed her hand against mine.
It's okay, she said as the hum of voices around us quieted down. They're taking their places. I need to go talk to the auctioneer. Find August, will you? And Tom, and... Oh!
Never let it be said that Lena couldn't make an entrance. She strolled in without even looking up from her crystal-encrusted iPhone. The clerk scurried to hold the door open for her like she was a queen. Around her shoulders, she wore a fur coat like a cape, and underneath, a top that barely covered her chest. It tied around itself, leaving a good 5 inches of skin bare above her painted-on leather pants. Her black hair had been dip-dyed blue and gold, and when she finally glanced up at the room, she rolled her eyes and reached out a hand for her bag. Which was when I noticed the three bodyguards behind her. Greystone mercs in disguise. They hustled her up to her seat in the front of the room, leaving a space beside her for Tom, who, with his suit, sweaty face, and handful of auction paddles, looked exactly like a pop star's put-upon assistant. This afternoon, Milo's text had created a constellation of websites and Snapchats and false news references and lyric videos for YouTube for Serena, the rising EDM star, and here she was, in the flesh, looking to build the art collection in her Laurel Canyon home. She'd requested an invitation before dinner, one that the Moriartys quickly granted. Philippa may have known Holmes and I would be here in disguise, but we wanted her to think that Serena was the real deal. Philippa rushed over to say hello to the pop star, Hadrian at her side. It had to be Hadrian. He was blonde and tall, but moved with the hunched-over jerkiness of a crab. I watched him for a moment, Hadrian in his natural form. I looked for signs of Nathaniel. Hadrian's nose was longer, his eyebrows thinner and higher up on his forehead. All Nathaniel's warmth and openness wasn't there. Since the Moriartys were distracted, Holmes seized the opportunity to talk to the auctioneer, slipping something small into his pocket. She took her seat again before they saw her. A hush fell over the room. We were about to begin. A pair of armed guards took their position to either side of the stage. Moriarty men, there to stop any trouble before it began.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
Hadrian cried, rushing up the stairs to the stage. His voice had the same timbre as Nathaniel's, though it sounded less educated, somehow, rougher.
"Thank you so much for spending your Christmas Eve with us. We love seeing you all at our private auctions. Your loyalty means ever so much. We extend these invitations selectively, and we appreciate your discretion. That said, since ours is a family affair, we understand yours is as well. This will be a far briefer showing than usual, so we can get you all back to your homes for mince pies and fruitcake."
Fruitcake? No wonder the Moriartys were all so miserable, if that was their idea of Christmas.
"Let's begin," he said,
and when he stepped off the stage, he was immediately pulled aside by August Moriarty. Things were in motion. The auctioneer began the proceedings with a painting by Hans Langenberg. It was a clear challenge, a way to feel out our motivations. As it was announced, Philippa craned her neck to stare at Holmes, who shrugged back at her with a smile.
"A work from the same era as the last of August," the auctioneer said.
A screen behind the painting listed facts about the piece.
"Notice the brushwork, the use of ecru, here in the corners. The faces of the two boys are turned from the viewer's eyes, but we can tell, even at this angle, that the artist has chosen not to detail their features. But the girl between them has those striking brows and red mouth. See the wild expression on her face that the painter has suggested with only a few lines? The map in her hand? This is an exquisite work. We'll open bidding at 100,000.
There was a small flurry of discussion, and paddles began going up in the air. Numbers 103, 282, 78. In the front row, Tom leaned in to whisper a question in Lena's ear. She nodded without looking up from her phone. Eagerly, he stuck their paddle 505 in the air. The price went up. 505 went up too, every time, and soon the other numbers, one by one, began to drop out of the running. I should have been paying attention to the auction, not to August and Hadrian off to the side, their heads together, arguing in fierce whispers. Twice, Hadrian turned to look at me over his shoulder and was wrenched back by his brother. We'd never spoken, not while he wasn't in disguise, and so the intense hatred in his eyes startled me. It looked so personal. I'd been having fun until that moment, a tense sort of fun, but fun all the same. It was shocking to me that this was fun at all, that this was even happening to me. I was about to take down some elite art auction in the Czech Republic on Christmas Eve. What jerked me back down was the realization that Hadrian clearly wanted to dismember me. I didn't want to imagine how he felt about Charlotte Holmes. Right then, glaring at me, he didn't look a thing like Nathaniel. For the millionth time, I wondered if Leander was wrong. I wondered if Leander was still alive. Slowly, I moved closer until I could hear the edges of their conversation. August was trying to refocus his brother's attention.
"Look at me," he hissed. "If you're claiming all this madness is about me, about my death, then you'll bloody well look at me when we're talking."
900,000, the auctioneer was calling.
Lena tapped Tom's shoulder, and he raised paddle 505 again. On the stage, Philippa's greedy smile grew.
"Sold," he crowed.
to 505. Our next work is also by Hans Langenberg.
The Moriartys were mocking us. One by one, they hauled up their faked Langenberg paintings and auctioned them off for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Even Hadrian, still in the throes of conversation with August, kept turning to grin at his sister. The guards standing with semi-automatics to the sides of the stage would keep Holmes and me from making any obvious move on their life. If we tried, we'd forfeit our own. 3 paintings, 5 paintings, 6. The auctions went up, and Lena, in her disguise, won them. Every single time. The Moriartys would have confirmed her banking information ahead of time when they'd accepted her request to join. They felt certain about these sales, about that money. Underneath my mask, I was starting to sweat. I knew we were nearing the end.
"And the thought of a pocket watch goes to number 505, the auctioneer said as the painting was hauled off the stage.
The crowd began to grumble amongst themselves. I couldn't blame them. They were, for the most part, older, conservative art aficionados who came out on Christmas Eve in pursuit of new work, only to be outbid by a teenage pop star who wouldn't stop cracking her gum.
"That's the last one," I heard Hadrian say to August.
He put a hand on his brother's shoulder.
"I'll wish them all good night, and then we can finish our conversation."
August smiled thinly.
"Yes," he said. "Do."
Before Hadrian could take more than a step, the auctioneer cleared his throat.
"We have a final piece to present, one that isn't in your catalogues."
The room fell silent. Philippa started toward the auctioneer, her smile frozen on her face. Holmes beat both of them to the punch.
"Ah, yes," she said,
standing from her seating in the back of the room, stretching her arms out to her sides.
"Yes, I am very excited for this." "It's Elmira Davenport," Peterson said in a loud whisper. "I wonder if it's one of her early pieces."
The man next to him nodded sagely.
"Davenport really is the future of video art."
"I've always said so," said his wife.
She must have sensed that she was losing control of the situation, because Philippa reached out and grabbed the auctioneer by the arm hard.
"Miss Davenport," she said in a carrying voice, "surely we can fit your work into our next showing."
"Let us show it now," called Peterson.
"Yes,"
another voice called.
"None of us are taking home anything. Give us a chance."
Tom turned to Lena and said loudly,
"You're not interested in video art, are you?"
"I hate it," she said in a dull voice.
"She hates it,"
someone repeated, and then the room began to buzz. The museum's high walls of the room gathered their voices and looped it on itself. It sounded almost like a swarm of bees was descending from the ceiling. On the stage, Philippa bit her lip so hard it turned white. August held Hadrian in place with a firm hand, and while the armed guards looked across the room at each other, I was watching, they made no movement toward their weapons. Into that anticipation, Holmes and I climbed up onto the stage. The auctioneer backed away from the podium, letting Holmes step up in his place.
"Hello, all. Yes, this is Elmira Davenport. That is my name. That said, I feel that you should call me whatever it is that you want to call me. Identity is so stifling. It is a construct."
"A pernicious construct," I intoned.
"Identity is slippery. We go by many names. Our many selves have different wants. Today I am in Prague, away from my family on a day meant to be with family. And am I family without them?"
"She is not."
"I am not."
"She is not family without family," I intoned.
"Today I am here by chance. I heard about this auction and decided, yes, I will show you a piece to illustrate who I am, who you are, who we all are underneath our wrappings. Kincaid beside me, he hides from the cameras. He hides his face from your faces. What is a face?"
She paused there, looking distantly over the audience's heads. They stared up at her, enraptured or pretending to be.
"Ah," she said with the solemnity of a sage, "no one knows what a face is. I have my theories. A face produces voice. A voice carries sound. In that sound we find ourselves prisoners. Now I show you a piece that says faces, family, identity, prisoners, all these things.
I nodded. This is a piece about all these things.
The screen behind the easel went dark. Moments later, the whole echoing room followed. There was a shuffling, some gasps. On the stage, a small scuffle, and the moments stretched into each other until the black-and-white video finally began to play. It was surveillance footage. The outside of a warehouse is seen from above. A giant man wiped off his hands on his pants. He straightened, stared into the distance. Then he bent, and with a visible, heaved breath, hoisted the limp body lying at his feet up and over his shoulder.
It was my body, but the audience didn't need to know that. My identity wasn't important to this story.
Static crackled from invisible speakers set somewhere behind the stage. From them, a girl's voice threaded out, broken-sounding, desperate.
"What exactly do you hope to accomplish here?" she asked. "You can't hope to hold us for more than a few hours."
The man dipped his head.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Where should I put the boy?"
"Be careful with him,"
the girl said, stepping into frame. I wondered what the audience made of her. She was slight, swaying in her boots, in her tiny dress.
"Please, he's my... be careful."
At that, the giant said something inaudible and carried the body away. It was just the girl in the frame now. She wrapped her arms around herself.
"I suppose you'll want our phones," she said.
A pause where a response should be. The girl was speaking to someone who wasn't in the picture.
"I'm just trying to help you to be thorough," she said, and pulled hers out of her bra, dangling it from her fingers. "Here, you can have it."
In the audience, a young man's reedy voice.
"Don't you love the composition of this shot?"
Holmes shifted her weight next to me.
"No, I won't bring it to you," the girl said. "What makes you think I'll be a party to my own destruction?"
"Past events have suggested it," the voice responded, barely audible.
A woman's voice, but the speaker was still off screen.
"I'm happy to help you in any way I can. You're welcome to try to run if you want. See how far you can get. Go on, we can time you." "You must be waiting for more guards," the girl said. "You have a pistol in your pocket, but you're too chicken shit to try to threaten me with it, even though I'm unarmed."
An incomprehensible reply. The girl took a step forward, then another.
"Why are you doing this?"
"Stop moving," the voice said.
"No," she cried. "Where are you taking him?"
"Are you blind? He's in the warehouse, where you'll be. We have business to discuss."
You could see her now, the back of her black and white head, blonde and curled.
"Is this worth it? You abduct my uncle, lock him away God knows where, all so that you can continue selling your forged paintings?"
A gasp from the audience, a series of coughs.
"How much are you making off of them? Is it enough blood money for you? Where is my uncle? He'll blow this up. He's a detective. We'll take this to the media, I swear it."
She gave her speech clearly. She enunciated her consonants. She stated facts that were pure exposition, and she said each word with a clarity of emotion that was meant for a Broadway production. I turned to her, the now her, the one beside me, and grinned, even though she couldn't see it under my mask. Holmes, my patron saint of trapdoors and fail-safes, of always remembering to pour the foundation so that later, if you needed to, you could build a brilliant house on top. It was her show, after all. In the video, Philippa took a staggering step forward, and when she turned her head, her face was clearly visible.
"You should ask yourself where your uncle is," she said, like some leering villain,
and the audience began to stir. Someone stood and said,
"Is this fake? Was this staged?"
The rustle of chairs pushed back, paddles dropped to the floor. The video kept rolling.
"Do you think you're such a genius?" Philippa said. "What if I told you he was right under your nose the whole time?"
"Oh, God,"
Past Holmes said, with a gasp loud enough to be picked up by the bug in her coat. That was how she'd gotten the audio, she'd told me. The Moriartys had hacked into the bug in her shoe, the one that Milo had put there to track her movements. She'd had one of the Greystone techs break into the Moriarty servers to look for audio she could use for her installation. The security footage was their own, she'd said. We found it when we broke in to get the recording. They'll kick themselves over that one.
How could you? How...
Finally, Philippa said as guards swarmed in to grab the girl and frog march her out of the frame. Took you long enough. The sound of a door slamming. Then the video cut off. A low-pitched static snuffle. Silence. When the lights came back up, three things happened in quick succession. One, the audience of grandmothers and grandfathers and genteel sons and daughters rioted. There wasn't any other word for it. A man picked up his chair and threw it at the stage, and then the woman beside him followed, and then another, another, like children throwing bricks at a glass window to see it shatter. The elderly women I'd seen walk by earlier, the ones with the jeweled reindeer pins and fancy Christmas hats, turned like synchronized dancers to run for the door. The clerk held it open. I had to give him credit. He wore the same impassive expression he did when the night began. Two, the Greystone guard who had been holding Philippa Moriarty to the side of the stage, one hand over her mouth, was sent staggering backward when she threw an elbow into his face. I ran to help the guard up, who waved me off. Philippa was running, arms pumping, toward the winding marble stairs to the museum proper. The sign above her head said, "Sculpture Wing." I pulled off my plastic mask and made to follow her. Tom and Lena and the rest of the Greystone guards followed suit. I made it off the stage and three more feet when I skidded to a stop, but they sprinted on ahead, tearing up the stairs, shouting her name. Three, Hadrian Moriarty ripped off Charlotte Holmes's wig and glasses and put a gun to her head. "Go help my sister," he told his own guards, and they took off up the stairs. "As for you, girl," he said, "you wanted to see your uncle. I'll send you there, then." And he pushed the mouth of the gun hard into her temple. Holmes's face went white. She didn't flinch, didn't make a sound. Only her colorless eyes moved, darting back and forth like she was reading lines from a book I couldn't see. "You know as well as I do that Leander is alive," August said, stalking out from the shadows. A knife glittered in one fist. "So please, stop making canned threats and be a person, Hadrian." "He's alive?" I asked August, not taking my eyes from Hadrian. "You're sure of it?" "I'm sure of it. Factually sure." "Which means you have to be involved," I said. Hadrian's gun still had the safety on. His other hand was wrapped around her throat. "How?" "I'm dead, Jamie." "Will you stop acting like you're the goddamn star of a goddamn tragedy and answer my question?" August took a slow step toward his brother. "This summer, Hadrian saw me at a punk show here in Berlin. I was in deep cover. It was the first time I'd gone out alone since everything happened." He jerked his head. "Word got back to my brother, but I only found out that night. I met up with Nathaniel, or I guess I should say, with Hadrian." "You're posing as a teacher," I said to Hadrian. It came out as a sneer. "You're disgusting." At that, he ground the gun into Holmes's head. I clenched my fists. "You don't know a single blessed thing about me, Simon." "So August helped you?" While Hadrian was preoccupied with me, his brother had moved even closer. "No, of course not. I found out that Nathaniel had been letting my brother pose as him for his meetings with Leander, for those nights at the underground pool where Hadrian trolls for new art. Nathaniel Ziegler is a real person. He teaches during the day, has friends, an apartment in a crappy part of the city. But he's been letting my brother moonlight as him. Apparently Milo's intelligence made that possible. That and my brother's money. And I'm sure that made it easier to convince Nathaniel to recruit his students to forge paintings for him to sell. All but the Langenbergs. Those Hadrian did himself." "I'm sure you're so proud," I spat. "Yes, well," he gripped his knife. "As usual, I'm thrilled to be part of my family." "And you knew Leander was alive. Do you know where he is?" August hesitated.
"No," he said.
"This is all beautiful, really," Hadrian said calmly. "But I'd like to get on with it."
At that, Holmes shut her eyes. Her mouth moved, almost like she was counting.
"What do you want?" I asked him. "It's simple." He cocked the safety off his pistol. "I want her dead. She spent the night wrecking my livelihood, my reputation. My reputation is everything. Did you see how much she was enjoying herself? Yesterday she put my bodyguard in the hospital. She crushed his windpipe. She killed you, August. You have no future. You have nothing now. She's a child that thinks she can play with adults, and she needs to understand that this isn't a game."
He dug his fingers into the flesh of her throat, and Holmes gagged.
"Lucien and I might disagree on our methods, but our goal is the same. We want her punished. My brother wants to draw this out. I want it over. Now."
I had no weapon, no plan. I wanted Milo then, desperately.
Where was he? Why was he in Thailand? Since when had we gone from solving the case ourselves, from our dorm room, to relying on his resources? We were in Europe. In Europe, and alone. How had this happened? In August, gripping that blade like he knew how to use it. That was a lie, too. Even now, he held it up in front of him like it was a candle or a prayer. So much for geniuses. So much for getting out of this alive.
August put the knife to his own throat. "Hadrian," he said calmly. "Drop the gun." His brother stared back at him. They looked so much alike. The nose, the square jaw. A pair of mirrors on either side of a black-haired girl. Only the eyes were different. August's were suffused with such bitter melancholy that, looking at him now, I didn't doubt his intentions.
"Stop pretending," Hadrian said, "that you care about what happens to her. What are you even doing?"
With a steady hand, August pressed the knife harder into his skin. A red stitch of blood sprang up on either side of its blade. Hadrian's brows furrowed.
"What the hell are you—"
"She killed me," he said. The blood trickled down his neck, a strange echo of what leaked even now from my own cuts. Involuntarily, I touched my own throat.
"You keep saying it. Lucien screamed it the night the police came to her house to haul us away. My brother took the fall for me, went to jail for a few months for selling coke, but sure, who's counting? And because of that, I'm in hiding. Forever. I'd worked my arse off for years to get where I was. I persuaded people to believe in me, despite my name. They expected me to be a monster. They expected me to be like you. And now—"
August laughed wildly, a high-pitched sound that must have moved his throat because the knife cut in still deeper.
"What does it matter? I have nothing. You saved my life, and then you cast me out, and I live in Milo Holmes's gilded tower. I'm in the wreckage of it all. All I have left are my ethics. Do you know how I do it? Live my life. All I think about is, what would Lucien do? And then I do the opposite. Spy on Milo's mercenary operation? Of course he would. Poison Charlotte's parents just to watch her agonize? He'd do that too. Tell this Watson kid to stick around so that I could mess with his head, use him to get to her? No. I warned him. I stole one of Milo's cars and drove him around, and orchestrated a bloody massive scheme to try to convince him to go home. What would Lucien do? Plot this teenage girl's death because she was a drug addict, and lost, and confused, and no one ever loved her, and she lashed out at me when I couldn't give her what she wanted.
His voice quickened. Lucien hates her for that, and despite everything else, despite everything I do, I guess I'm a failure because I hate her for that too. I hate her. I hate her. And I don't hate her at all. A deep breath. I refuse to let myself see her as anything but what she is. She's a lost girl. And I was a lost boy for all those years, too, growing up.
And you used to know what you were, Hadrian. You used to go to plays with me, and stay up late, reading A Wrinkle in Time. And you'd make things out of clay, and we'd bake them in the oven when Mum wasn't around to complain about the smell, and some of them cracked. But you make beautiful art.
Shut up, Hadrian said.
Even those Langenberg paintings. I know your handiwork, Hadrian. They're beautiful.
Stop, he said, begging.
Just stop. You were my older brother. I looked up to you. I don't anymore,
August said.
You say you want to kill her for me. But if you do it, if you kill her, I swear to God I'll end myself too. It's all the same to me. You've made sure of it.
I was aware of my body then, my useless limbs, how heavy and damaged they were, how slow I'd be to stop either of them. Behind the stage, up in the wings, there was shouting, like maybe Tom and Lena and the Greystone Mercs had caught Philippa after all. They'd be bringing her back down, their guns in tow, and with every pistol pointed at everyone else, this could only get more complicated. Throughout all of this, through August's confession, the blade to his neck, Holmes's eyes hadn't once focused on him. They weren't focused on me, either. They were shut, as gently as though she were sleeping.
"Charlotte!"
Lena called from an upper balcony.
"We caught her! We caught her! I think I gave her a black eye!"
In front of me, Holmes took a ragged breath. She opened her eyes. In one smooth motion, she grabbed Hadrian's arm, the one with the gun, and wrenched it away from her while she slammed the back of her head into his face. Hadrian Moriarty yelled, staggering backward, and she disarmed him, neatly, with a single hand. His pistol went off into the floor. A pause where no one really knew what to do, and then Charlotte Holmes dove down on top of him, pressing his nose down into the marble ground, pinning his arms behind his back.
"August," she said over her shoulder, "if you're done trying to kill yourself, will you please fetch me some handcuffs?"
13. We flew, all of us together, back to England on one of Milo's military-grade planes, me and Holmes and August, and a pair of Moriartys in chains. Not to mention the armed guards, still nameless and interchangeable, all staring at Hadrian and Philippa like they were rabid dogs about to slip their leashes.
"Mr. Holmes has requested that we watch them closely until you arrive to claim them," a soldier said when I asked what was going to happen next.
"Are they under arrest? Proper arrest, like going to jail?"
Holmes shrugged.
"Does it matter?" she said. "We'll dispose of them one way or another. Sussex first, though, please."
"When will Milo get here?" I asked.
"He's on his way now," she said. "He has information about Lucien that he needs to tell me in person."
August stared down at his hands.
"Can you take the two of them somewhere else?" he asked quietly,
and the soldiers hauled his brother and sister to the back of the plane and out of view. We'd left Tom and Lena at the Prague airport. They were about to catch a flight back to Chicago to spend Christmas with Tom's family. A compromise, Tom told me, for having spent so much of his break bumming around Europe with Lena.
"And your parents agreed to let you be away all this time?" I asked.
We were at the curbside drop-off. Holmes and Lena were inside, arranging for the faux Langenberg paintings to be delivered back to Germany. It was Christmas Day. Everything but the airport was closed. He nodded at me, hands in his pockets.
"Her family's paying for it all, you know. My parents figured it might be my best chance to do some traveling. They can't afford any of this stuff. Even after I got suspended, they thought, well, why pass up an opportunity?"
So they weren't the parents of the year. I was beginning to understand Tom a bit more.
"Was it worth it? I mean, did you and Lena have fun?"
To my surprise, Tom shook his head.
"I kind of miss them, my family. After all the crap that happened this semester, I thought I wanted to escape them. But, like, Lena and I went to all these fancy restaurants and crazy stores where they make you tea while she tried on dresses, and, yeah, it was all interesting, but I kind of miss my couch and my TV. And then the stuff with you and Charlotte?"
"Yeah." I pulled my hat down further around my ears. Without that plastic mask, I felt self-conscious in public, especially now that my bruises were beginning to turn green around the edges. I looked like a piece of rotting meat. August had a bandage around his neck. Holmes wasn't speaking to anyone except Lena, and then only in dark whispers. I didn't need Tom to tell me that the last few days had been hard.
"Dude, just... you need to get yourself out. Now. Like, guns? Soldiers for hire? A whole family of weirdos trying to kill your girlfriend? You're not married to her, and I really like Charlotte. I think she's interesting and honestly really scary. But I kind of think that if you keep following her around, you're going to wind up dead."
"August's taken care of it," I said. Tom shrugged.
"Maybe. If so, it's a hell of an anticlimax, isn't it?"
Before I could respond, Holmes and Lena came through the sliding doors in their dark jackets and hats. Lena slipped her gloved hand into Tom's back pocket.
Ready? She asked. Let me know if the Germans don't reimburse you for the cost of those paintings, Holmes said to her. The Moriartys had some nerve, auctioning every last one of them off. I think you have a complete set. I don't think my surveillance videos would be permissible in court, but we do have enough evidence to at least lean on the government to write you a check. It'll be fine, Lena said. I kind of like the paintings anyway. I might put one in our room this spring.
Holmes nodded tightly.
If they give you trouble, she said, tell them to shine a flashlight onto the canvases to look for cat hair.
Cat hair?
Hadrian's trouser cuffs were coated in it. White, she said. So I assume it's one of those wretched long-haired Persians. Hans Langenberg famously died alone. It was weeks before they found him, since I haven't read anything about his face being eaten.
I wondered how long she'd been sitting on that information.
No cats, got it. I'll tell them, if they ask.
Lena leaned in to kiss her roommate on the cheek, leaving a smudge of red where her lips had been.
Bye, guys. Merry Christmas. See you back at school.
Holmes smiled briefly.
Go on. You'll miss your flight.
We met August at the airstrip. The Greystone plane was there waiting for us, and he was too, standing at the foot of the stairs with windswept hair and exhausted eyes. He looked like a photograph of himself rather than the real thing. We all nodded to each other, too tired to say much. When we boarded and took our seats, Holmes huddled up against me. She tugged my arm down around her shoulders. Through the layers of sweaters and scarves and coats, I could still feel her shivering, and so I held on to her more tightly. She'd almost died. We both had. I still wasn't sure why we were alive, where her brother was, why we were headed back to Sussex at all. Her mother was still in a coma. Leander was still lost. We'd pulled off a feat back in Prague, to be sure, but had things veered off 1 inch to the left or the right, the three of us would all be in refrigerated drawers. I was still processing it there in the museum lobby, my mask in my hands, when Holmes looked down at a handcuffed Hadrian Moriarty and said grimly, "I suppose there's no delaying it further. We need to go home."
"Go then," August had said. "No," she told him. "You're coming with."
She'd refused to answer further questions. I was done trying to ask them. The Moriartys were brought in and then brought to the back. The plane took off. We looked at each other.
"So what now, for you?" I asked August.
He shrugged.
"I don't know," he said. I think maybe I've been lying to myself a little bit."
"Really now?" Holmes said. "No sarcasm from you," he said it with a half a smile. "I disappeared because my parents wanted me to. Really, I took that job working in your house in the first place because they wanted me to, and I took that job from your brother at Greystone because I was so determined to try to bring an end to this war. A lot of good that did. But tonight's shown that I don't have to do it anymore."
"Greystone?" I asked.
"Any of it," he said. "Make peace, offer up my life. Now I might go back to my academic work in maths, take on a persona. A new one, you know, built it up from the ground. I could forge some records, or maybe I could even do my defill again. Might be nice to take my time this time, get a teaching job somewhere. I hear Hong Kong has a nice expat scene. Maybe I'll go there."
I snorted. "It's not a big deal to do your doctorate again?"
"What would you rather do, Jamie? Data entry for the rest of your natural life?" He grinned. "Even if that's your calling, you'll be safe. My brother Lucien won't touch you. Not if he knows he'd be ending my life, too."
"I don't know if we can count on that."
August shrugged. "Forgive me if I don't feel the need to reassure you of your safety. It's not like you think it's important. I kidnapped you and told you to go home, warned you about the dangers of your situation, and all you did was double down."
I stared at him. Even after hearing him tell Hadrian, after hearing him say it now, I still couldn't quite believe him.
That, instead of telling me, "Hey, maybe you're in danger, Jamie," which would have been too easy, or unpsychopathic.
To my surprise, August looked over at Holmes. "I was raised to solve problems in a particular way." His voice was clipped and rough, a simulation of hers. "Generally, I ignore my education.
There it seemed apt. I keep my promises, Charlotte.
Holmes scoffed.
You were serious. You were serious about killing yourself to save us.
I was serious about that.
Hong Kong, I echoed.
I tried to imagine it. The August from the photos, from the research I'd done. With a professorial beard and a briefcase and a whole bunch of papers to grade. Somewhere out of reach. Somewhere far away from all this. I couldn't hold on to the image. It didn't seem possible that you could walk away from this burning wreck with a brand new name and no scars but the scratch on your neck.
Well, good luck with that, Holmes said, leaning back into my coat.
Stop being a child, Charlotte, he said.
I'm not being a child. I'm being realistic. How can you believe that your brother isn't a complete monomaniac? That he has compunctions? You think he won't hunt you down for sport?
She barked a laugh.
You'd use the name Felix. You teach at an English-speaking university. I could find you within 10 minutes. Lucien, within seconds.
This isn't about me, he said formally. It's about you. You're hurt that I said those things. I understand, you know. It can be difficult.
Difficult?
Actions have consequences.
Don't you trot out that patronizing bullshit with me, August. I can't stand it.
He threw up his hands.
I thought of you as the last good one, of all of us. I thought you'd forgiven me. How could I? How could I possibly when...
August cleared his throat. You know where Leander is. It wasn't a question.
Why do you think we're going back to Sussex?
How? How long have you known?
No.
She peered at him over my arm.
First show your work.
That expression crept across August's face again, the one I'd seen him smother so many times before. This time he didn't try to mask it. Bit by bit, it played out, the look of a man who's torched his own house, only to fall in love with the flames. He hated himself, anyone could tell that. The bandage around his neck was still stained red. But I don't think he hated Charlotte Holmes as much as he claimed. I think it was something else completely. Did he want to be her? Did he want to be with her? It didn't matter now. This was the tail end, the epilogue. After what he'd said to us in Prague, I couldn't imagine our paths would run together much longer. August leaned forward in his seat, his hands steepled before him.
You haven't had any urgency on this matter since we've arrived. All the tools in the world to track down your uncle, and instead you play back the same voicemail again and again, not picking it apart for analysis, but listening to it like you're mourning for him. My brother and sister were at your disposal, at your mercy. You held them at gunpoint, and then at an auction that you demanded they hold, and instead of extracting information from them, by force, about your uncle's whereabouts, don't give me that look, I know precisely how bloodthirsty you are, you show a cute little surveillance video that implicates them in his disappearance, and then you buy up all the Langenberg paintings, 1, 2, 3. There's no hard evidence there. It's bad detective work, plain and simple. You're solving this sloppily, Charlotte, with money and borrowed power, and you're going to use Milo, who, unlike you, has a moral code underneath all that expediency, to put them in whatever black box you put Bryony in. It's like you're trying to race to some end before the howling wolves catch you, and that would make sense if you feared for Leander's life, but you don't. And now you're saying he's been in England the whole time. I don't know what you're doing, but why are you dragging me along?
I wasn't holding her anymore. I was blank, in shock, trying quickly to catch up. No, that was a lie, and I knew it. But there had been something wrong with the way Holmes had gone about all of this from the moment we touched down in Berlin, and all my exhausted heart could do was hope that August had come to the wrong conclusions.
"My brother is meeting us there," Holmes said. "We need to speak to my father, and then we all need to go. Immediately. All three of us."
She turned from him, burying her face in the cloth of my coat. August pulled a notebook from his pocket. He turned it over in his hands. And me, I felt so thoroughly betrayed, so abandoned, that I hardly knew what to think. She was holding on to me like she thought it was the last time I'd let her. And if she's kept all this from me, maybe it should be, I thought, and stared out the darkened window, waiting for the first lights of London to appear. We took a cab to the train, and the train down to Eastbourne, and a black car from the station up to her family's estate. There was snow on the ground, a dusting of it that turned and turned in the wind. We weren't speaking to each other. None of us. I didn't know what to say to August, especially now, and I didn't try. As for Holmes, she'd disappeared into her magician's trunk and swallowed the key. There wouldn't be any prying her out, not until the big reveal. I thought I knew what it might be. I hoped I was wrong. The house came into view at the end of the drive, and beside me I heard August draw a sharp breath. He hadn't been back here since the night he had Lucien deliver his latest shipment of coke. This was the last place he'd been August Moriarty. It didn't seem to register for Holmes. She sat between us, hands folded in her lap. Her jaw was set. "You need to decide what we do with Hadrian and Philippa," she said to August.
"I thought you'd made that Milo's call."
"Greystone is keeping them subdued. I want you to decide what happens next."
"Can't we ask Milo his opinion?"
Without looking, Holmes pointed out the window.
"He isn't here," she said. "Ours are the only tracks in the drive. Things are about to happen very quickly. Make a decision, or else I will."
August sighed.
"It's difficult, Charlotte. That's my brother. My sister. I don't know."
"Damn it, August. Milo will have them killed. That's what happened to Bryony. All right? What do you want? Make a decision."
The car began to turn down onto the long drive, but Holmes told the driver to stop. August sat stunned and unspeaking. Holmes took a breath.
"Fine," she said, measured again, and leaned over me to pull the door handle. "I'll do it my way, the way I've wanted to all along. God help me. Watson, get out."
"What are you..." She pushed me, and I stumbled out onto the gravel on my hands and knees. Holmes followed, and before she slammed the door on August's face, I heard her say,
"You always sit back and let someone else be the monster. Hadrian, Lucien, me, as a matter of fact, but it stops now. Let's go."
I knelt there on the ground in disbelief. I'd never seen her do anything that cruel. Never, at least, to me. Even now, she was stepping over me, wrapping her scarf more tightly around her throat, and instead of heading down the drive, she took off down the salted path that cut through her house's backyard, careful, even in her haste, to keep from leaving footsteps in the snow. Behind me, August clambered out of the car and offered me a hand up.
"Do we follow her?" he asked.
I was brushing the gravel off of my knees.
"What do you think?"
We weren't as careful as she'd been not to leave footprints, though I tried. Even now the light was fading at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and behind us and down the cliffs to the sea, the water raged against the rocky shore. Holmes didn't once glance back at us. She moved quickly through the grounds, head down, keeping to the stands of bare trees and bushes until she reached the house. The woodpile was there, the one I'd worked with Leander, my axe still standing upright in its fallen log. It didn't interest her, not in the slightest. The basement windows did, low to the ground, and Holmes was pulling a metal pick out from the inside pocket of her coat. She studied its sharpened edge for a moment, before jamming it into the top of the window frame, pulling it free from its hinges. I was at her heels then, and she handed it up to me.
"You didn't tell Milo about this access point?" August asked, behind me. "If he's worth his salt, 12 alarms are going off at Greystone right now."
She dusted off her hands.
"Come on."
Down into a storage room, all rakes and hose and storage bins, and through the door into a room that looked like it had been used as a training ring. For combat, maybe, or for something else, but there was a dirt ring in the middle of the floor lined with tape. On the walls were knives and wooden staffs, a set of fencing foils, a pistol with the orange plastic ring around its mouth that meant it was a toy. Did Alistair use it when training his daughter to disarm an enemy? Black ribbons hung from a pipe, thick enough to be blindfolds, and below that were coils of rope, a wooden chair with its seat cut out. I didn't look too closely. After all my wild curiosity, the years I spent as a boy dreaming of the training I could get from the Holmes family in spying and deduction, how I could be transformed into a weapon at their hands, and here it was, the proof. When I'd asked him for training, my father had given me spy novels to read, but Alistair and Emma had put their children through their paces until they gleamed like blades. The basement smelled like cedar chips and mold. A set of stairs led up to the main level. Already Holmes was at the door at the far end of the room. She tried the knob once, twice, then pulled out her pick again and got to her knees.
"This door isn't ever locked," she said to herself, as if in confirmation.
The door was reinforced with steel bars. The lock was the old-fashioned kind, with a large keyhole you could peer through. I was reminded of the doors I'd liked so much in Prague. What had Holmes said were behind them? Tourist shops? I peered up at the doorframe. "It's wired," I told her, pointing up. "There must be a keypad on the other side, some kind of alarm system." "On the far side?" August asked. "I know this house. The only entrance into that room is from this door." "What's inside?" I asked him, but he looked away. Holmes moved the pick to the left, then the right, and paused.
"The silent alarm is about to sound. If we haven't been detected already, we will be now. I don't want commentary on what you see. I don't want judgment. I want you to follow me in, and then we move out."
She looked ill. Pale, drawn, her eyes flat as coins. And with that last confirmation, I let myself think it, make it into words, the thing I'd known since we boarded that flight back to England but hadn't wanted to believe. Leander was being kept in this house, in this room. I didn't know why, though I had my suspicions, or what the consequences were of springing him free, but as Holmes picked the lock, humming that strange, tuneless melody under her breath, even now she was a creature of habit, I tried not to think about what would happen next, after. If he was still alive in there. A click, a creak. Holmes charged in before me on her long legs, August muscling past me to follow, and all I saw at first were their coats as I pushed in after them. There was a low buzz in the air, like the vibration of a phone going off in a pocket, but amplified, something hanging between these cinder-block walls, this lightless room. It was coming from a generator, and the generator was powering a series of beeping machines, something that whirred and something that beeped, and something else that had clear plastic tubes and wires that wound up from its base and over to the hospital bed where Leander was lying in a blue cotton gown, his hair lank and greasy like it hadn't been washed since we'd left, a tube taped to his mouth as if to feed him, an IV tower next to him hung with bags that didn't hold saline and blood. I knew what saline and blood looked like. I'd been in the hospital enough myself. The room was scattered with crutches, a wheelchair, what looked like a Persian rug. It was a makeshift hospital. This was enough to stop me dead, more so than if the room had been set up for torture or interrogation. Though now that I looked more closely, I thought I saw the metal hardware for hooks and chains still attached to the walls and the ceiling. The idea that Leander had been here, underneath everything, sedated to be kept out of the way of whatever plan was in play. Except that he wasn't sedated. He was awake. And Emma Holmes hovered over him in a mask and a lab coat, a scalpel in one latex-gloved hand. Then she reached over and yanked the cord from the security camera in the corner. Instinctively, I searched my pockets for a weapon. Next to me, August did the same, coming up with nothing but the stained knife he'd pulled out in the museum in Prague. Charlotte Holmes rushed over and flung herself into her mother's arms.
"Lottie,"
she said, one arm around her daughter, the other pulling off her mask.
"Excellent timing. He's fine to travel. We have about 4 minutes. Move."
Under Emma's swift direction, August helped her remove the IVs. I took socks and a sweater from the suitcase in the corner, Leander's, and helped him into them, taking care to lean in closely to his ear to whisper,
"Is she hurting you?"
"She isn't," he said, his voice strangely strong. "He is."
"Alistair? August?"
The latter was putting an arm under his legs now to help turn him off the bed and put him into the wheelchair.
"Get off me," Leander said and stood. "I'm fine."
"Where is Dr. Michaels?"
Holmes was asking her mother.
"Where is she being kept?"
"In my room,"
Emma said.
"Your brother had a camera put there. Is he secure? Leander, are you ready to go?"
I was shocked to hear her speak to him with such gentleness.
"Fastest way out," I said. "The window we came in?"
"Done.
Emma Holmes was pulling things from the suitcase, a pair of passports, an envelope, scarves and gloves and a hat, and stuffing them into the pockets of her lab coat.
Go, she said. I'll follow.
We ran. Leander kept pace behind us, moving far too quickly for a man who